again, officials, thanks for being here. We're meeting after we had an interesting outing with the oversight and the launch of AgroProtein yesterday in Philippines. Really, really was an eye-opener and very interesting. So it's true, next time you want to kill a fly, you think twice, right? But this fly is needed for job creation. we're going to give the department first, the DG, to take us through the first quarter financial and performance report, and then after that we'll have our final details in relation to the bill before the committee. DG, we're making quantum leaps, not just strides, on the bill, and we're hoping to adopt it today. And then we'll ATC it, and then we'll be told when it can be debated and sent to the NCOT. But it was a very interesting, exciting experience. And so we've also brought to the attention of the select committee, the NCOP, that when it goes to NCOP, the issue of the public hearings, because we have promised some stakeholders who could not make it on the 1 week and the written submission, that they still have an opportunity when the process is in the NCOP to make inputs and presentation and submissions when it comes to the provinces. So, and also the other process where we went to deep rural Natal, KZN and in Oudtshoorn was also an interesting. Some of the things which you didn't think of suddenly made sense, and on what does this bill actually entail. It is one of its kind. It has been said it's sui generis and really empowering. 3 weeks ago, we had there was a women's conference hosted by the speaker. And just during the conference, one lady says, "No, the only things we're concerned about is that we, the San and the Khoi, are not recognized." Yes, so I said, "Well, ma'am, there's a bill. Come and see me after this. We've met with the communities. They've made input. So you also have an opportunity when it comes to your area to participate." So. And that is one bill that has really ensured that every South African is heard and is given an opportunity to say their piece. So we're really, really excited about that. Without much waste of time, I don't think we need introduction. I'm not sure. Maybe let's do it. Just, my name is Lindwe Masebo, Chairperson of the committee. Honorable Matale.
Castle Matale, committee member.
Nobuzo Landomiani, committee member.
Good morning, Agnes Stack, committee member.
Nick Wernoff, committee member.
Chantal King, committee member.
Annelie Lothrit, member of the committee.
Azir Paulson, member of the committee.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Renee Osborne Mullins, the content advisor for the committee.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. I'm Martin Mulcahy, Special Advisor to the Minister.
Good morning, Director General of DST, Film Chuach.
Morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. My name is Tommy Makode. I'm DDG for Institutional Planning and Support.
Good morning, Honourable Members. I'm Yona Seleti, Chief Director for Science Missions and Indigenous Knowledge. Good morning, honourable members. My name is Henry Roman. I'm Acting Chief Director for Sector Innovation and the Green Economy.
Good morning, honourable members and Chairperson. I'm Kerry Faw. I'm the head of the National Intellectual Property Management Office, and I'm representing the DDG for Technology Innovation today. Thank you.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is Tom Suknandan from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, honourable members. I'm Carol van Zyk from the Department of Science and Technology.
Good morning, honourable members. My name is Mampe Chava, Chief Director, Multilateral Cooperation in Africa, representing DDG International Cooperation and Resources.
Good morning, honourable members. Charlene Monsami, DST Legal Services.
Good morning, Chair, honourable members. My name is Kenan Mleche, Department of Science and Technology, Deputy Minister's Office.
Good morning, members. My name is Luyanda France, PLOT Ministry.
Good morning, members. My name is Robert Shagu. I'm from the Department of Science and Technology, representing the CFO.
Good morning, Len Madiba, Department of Science and Technology, Monitoring and Evaluation.
Thank you very much. DG, it's over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members. We are here today to share with you the first quarter report, and the understanding is that the Portfolio Committee has requested that we come back for the annual report. I think we'll be coming in 2-3 weeks time, thereabout. Thank you very much. Maybe just to congratulate the Portfolio Committee on the IKS bill. We know that it's been a long journey, so we really are happy and like to congratulate you. So what I'd like to then do is to present quickly this first quarter performance. The mandate we have shared with the Portfolio Committee before, we want to our mandate is derived from the white paper, and I will talk a little bit about what we're trying to do on the current white paper in next slides. The NSI remains an ideal for which we would like to drive in order to make sure that we bring all the parties together. And we just give a little bit of a description of what the NSI concept is all about. We have two strategic documents, the National Research and Development Strategy and the 10-year Innovation Plan, strategy documents that help us to achieve the intent of the white paper, and then of course we were trying to make sure that in the 10-year innovation plan we make the transition, or at least we make sure that we have resource-based but also other knowledge-based economy-related activities. The vision: increase well-being and prosperity through science, technology and innovation, and the mission is to provide leadership and enabling environment and resources for science, technology and innovation in support of the development of South Africa. And then, as we have shown before, we support a number of outcomes of government, or outcome 2, outcome 4, 5, 6, 7, and 10. So the strategic outcome-oriented goals of the department is to have a responsive, coordinated, and efficient national system of innovation, increased generation of knowledge, human capital, using knowledge for economic development, and using knowledge for inclusive development. So we'll give a little bit of highlights on each of these strategic outcome-oriented goals, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, and then we'll go to the details of some of the targets, the ones that have been achieved and the ones that have not been achieved and the reasons why we haven't. So on the first one, or just roughly, we have achieved 66% of the targets for this quarter, and 34 of these have not been achieved on slide number 12.
and we will show the breakdown of how this comes apart from each of the programs of the DST. So if we start then with the first strategic-oriented outcome goals, some highlights. The National Advisory Council on Innovation conducted the scan of the existing policy and performance of the National System of Innovation, and we have used this as an input into the revision of the white paper. The highlights are, one, that we have done well in terms of our ability to generate knowledge, but our ability to convert and use knowledge for socio-economic development has remained relatively flat. However, one should always remember that sometimes these reviews are looking backward and they don't look on what you do currently. We have not started to get worried about that because we recently learned on some of the outputs that are coming from the work that the Technology Innovation Agency, the National Intellectual Property Management Office and the OTTs are doing, and we are of the opinion that we are on the right track, so there's no need for us to press the button yet, but we just need to accelerate those. Technical inputs from other government departments and some partners were incorporated into the draft white paper. We had consulted almost all the government departments that we work closely with. They gave us inputs. We received inputs also from, I think, five critical readers that were identified to help us to look at the white paper from a different perspective. We incorporated all of those, and then as we are expected in government to subject the white paper to the socio-economic impact assessment, we have received a certificate from DPME that looks at whether are the unintended consequences of the white paper. And then we also made a presentation to the economic sectors, employment and infrastructure development cluster that approved that we can take the bill to cabinet. We have then provided the minister with this document, an apologies spelling error at the bottom of page 3, and the minister has already looked at the document, and we will be getting feedback on, I hear that she would like us to just work on the flow of the document. So within the next couple of weeks, we should be able to finalize the document. And then, of course, to go to cabinet and the portfolio committee will then be given the details of what we're proposing going forward. The second piece of information we'd like to share with the portfolio committee is that the medium-term strategic framework is always revised halfway through the administration of government. After that was done, we've then, as the executive, looked at our strategic plan and made sure that it's still aligned to the revised MTSF, and making sure that the draft annual performance plan of 18-19 is already aligned to the revisions. And we've done that, and I think we've signed off on the draft APP and the changes that we are proposing on the strategic plan to go to DPME as well as the AG and National Treasury. And we continue to provide support to the economic sectors, employment and infrastructure development cluster, and we at the department run what is called the Project Management Unit, PMU, to support the 9-point plan of government. The CAB memo on budget coordination was approved, and it was approved by the asset cluster and submitted to Cabinet. In fact, Cabinet has approved this process, and we have started to engage with our colleagues at National Treasury on issues of ensuring that allocation of budgets to other science councils that do not report to the Minister of Science and Technology, that process is coordinated. And at an appropriate time, Honourable Chair would be more than happy to share with the committee the progress that we're making in this regard. And then we continue to support a range of other clusters within government. The National Research Foundation Amendment Bill was approved by Cabinet for submission to Parliament, so we would hope that very, very soon this will be presented to yourself as the Portfolio Committee. I'm alerted that next week on Wednesday it will be tabled to Cabinet. And so in the next weeks or so we should And then the bill has gone through the full public consultation and socio-economic impact assessment system, as indicated before. And then we've also received, or we have commissioned the Academy of Sciences, ASAF, to look at the challenges of postgraduate study in engineering, because we were approached by some universities that indicated that the support and the declining infrastructure for postgraduate training in some of the universities is less than ideal. So we said, before we do that, let's understand what the problem is. So this study is ongoing, hopefully to be completed by the end of March in 2018. On the second strategic oriented outcome goal, the increase in knowledge generation, we continue to provide grants through a number of instruments to strengthen the research capacity at universities. On the big data, we would like to report that the minister has gazetted the intention to establish a single observatory for radio astronomy activities in South Africa. The committee would remember that we have the Hadrao dish in Hartbeespoort. We've got the Meerkat with the intention to have 64 dishes soon, and then the precursor to the Meerkat, which was the 7 prototype in Carnarvon. So the idea is that it would be useful to have a single radio astronomy that consolidate all of these activities, and this would be called the Southern African Radio Astronomy, SARAO, as we call it. On the SKA front, 62 pedestals have been installed, and 58 dishes have already been lifted. And when we checked with the SKA director, we are confident that we will be on track to complete all of the dishes and have them working by the 31st of March 2018. Also, the Clairefontein Technical Training Center, temporary building has been acquired, and a temporary science visitor center has already been identified, and we are working with the provincial government and the Northern Cape together with the Department of Tourism to work out what the science visitor center would look like. We've also made progress in establishing the recommendations of the National Integrated Cyber Infrastructure System through the agency of the CSIR, the Meraka Institute. Some highlights out of this National Integrated Cyber Infrastructure is that the establishment of a node for this cyber infrastructure led by UCT has been established. And this node provides capacity for multidisciplinary data-intensive research. Also provides training for people we need and the infrastructure capability building. Now, just to explain a little bit, these tiers, Tier 1 is for national infrastructure, Tier 3 is institutional infrastructure, and therefore this regional Tier 2 is something that sits between the institution and the national infrastructure. And then the finalization of the curriculum for the introduction of the National E-Science Master's Degree Program has been established, led by the consortium at WITS. As you know that WITS is hosting infrastructure research in partnership with IBM, so it made sense that they lead this program. And then the finalization of the introduction of the National E-Research Support Program for providing research support to researchers who want to look at this area of work in partnership with the National Research Foundation. We also are happy that finally we now have 200 research chairs in the system, and they were supported and the amounts are given there, and 76 of course of these 200 researchers are women, 7 black, 1 colored, 7 Indian and 61 white. And the SARCHI program, as we all know, has been extremely successful in producing new knowledge measured by publications, human capital in terms of an increased number of masters and postgraduate students. And then we are working with the NRF and some of the research shareholders to assist in trying to accelerate our racial and gender transformation objectives. We continue to support the Centers of Excellence program. In fact, a week and a half ago, we had a meeting of all the directors of Centers of Excellence indicating the progress that they are making in this work, and we were grateful with the progress that has been made. On the bursary front, just over 2,000 PhD students have been supported. 4,000 pipeline students, honors and masters, and just over 2,000 researchers have been awarded research grants from the NRF. And we also are working closely with the NRF to ensure that the ministerial guidelines that ensures that 80% of postgraduate students that receive support are black, 55 women and 4% are people with disabilities, and that these guidelines are being adhered to. So we are working closely with the NRF to ensure that this is reported. We also provide support to some young graduates or students to place them in science, engineering, and technology institutions, and we're happy to report that for this quarter we had about 836 of these students being placed in these institutions, and we are making progress in the public understanding of science. All aware that we had the launch of the National Science Week, and we are happy that 93 grant holders were granted funding to support the week, and 93 science festivals, at least at this point, have participated. On the third area of using knowledge for innovation and economic development, we are happy to report on three highlights, maybe four. The one of the hydrogen centers of competence based at the Northwest University has sold technology that was developed within the center of competence to a local company, again demonstrating the relevance of research and the interest by the private sector on the work done. And then the biomanufacturing industry development center located at the CSIR continues to support entrepreneurs, 23 in total, and approximately 75 products have been completed and transferred to the private sector small companies. On this initiative, which is called the 3D printing or AeroSwift, we are happy to report that this AeroSwift, which is a large area powder bed additive manufacturing system for metallic components, is on track. This is the picture on the right hand side of the system, which basically uses lasers and melts the powder at the nozzle of the laser to manufacture complete parts that you see on the left-hand side of the picture. We are now having some of these parts being tested by renowned auto industries, and they are testing them and validating them as to whether they would be happy to buy them. And then, of course, we have to commercialize this unit, and we are on the phase three of the technology development contract with the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research to finalize the strategy to commercialize. On the indigenous knowledge-based agro-processing technologies, we are continuing to make progress, and we're happy to report that the Limpopo agro-processing facility for the Moringa project is on track, and the cooperative in Serikong from Tuseng community have started negotiations with Future Life, which is a private sector, for joint commercialization of their products. We're really excited about this, and we hope that the negotiations will be successful. We are happy to report on the partnership between the Medical Research Council and Novartis that have entered into a collaborative agreement. And the idea is to have a joint program in selected communicable and non-communicable diseases, from drug discovery all the way to preclinical and clinical research, as well as building on the infrastructure investment. Improving a patient's access to precision medicine, as the honorable members would know, in South Africa we've been asked to take full advantage of the biodiversity of genes that we have in South Africa and Southern Africa to take a lead in this area of precision medicine. So this is a very, very welcome partnership. And then build up a research and development ecosystem, not within South Africa, but within the SADC area in particular and the rest of the continent. And this relationship, of course, is managed by the Strategic Health Innovation Partnership, known as SHIP. On the international resources, we're happy to report on the workshop that was held between ourselves and the EU partners on open science. Just to briefly explain what is open science, it facilitates scientific research, data and dissemination accessible to all levels of inquiry in the society. It's essentially the fact that data is now freely available and what is the protocol that opens up research partnerships that would not have been possible if this data is not made available, because in most instances data was restricted to researchers that were producing it, but all over the world people are beginning to think about data as a source of new research in collaborative mode, and therefore we are grateful about this. So this open science encompasses practices such as publishing open research, campaigning for open access called data democracy, in other words, encouraging scientists to practice open notebook science, and generally making it easier to publish and communicate scientific knowledge and result. And this workshop has resulted in areas of collaboration further between South Africa and the European Union. We're also happy to report on a program which the colleagues at Overseas Bilateral as well as Program 4 host, by having young researchers meeting with Nobel laureates. It happens in Austria. So we supported 7 young scientists to attend this 67th Lindau Nobel laureate meeting in Germany, and Austria this time. The meeting was held 25th to the 30th of June, and as I say, you have 420 international young scientists and 28 Nobel laureates engaging and encouraging the young scientists to be perhaps inspired and possibly becoming Nobel laureates themselves. One of the South African delegates was chosen to speak on behalf of these young scientists at the closing ceremony. And then ASAF has appointed a communication specialist company to accompany the tour and publicize the presence of South African students. So hopefully we'll get a report on this. The minister hosted an Argentinian delegation where the ministers agreed on new areas of collaboration, including blue economy, increased infrastructure, and revive industries, bioeconomy, renewable ICT, in agriculture, space science, and climate change. We've had a good collaboration with the Argentinian government, and we are therefore happy to deepen this and maybe identify new areas. And of course, the minister also led the DST delegation in the last ministerial and the BRICS solid state lighting working group meeting that took place in China recently. And other partners were engaged under this period, including Norway, Iran, as well as Austria. On the multilateral cooperation in Africa, we have formalized collaboration between South Africa and the Seychelles, which was acknowledged by the Vice President of the Seychelles. The third iteration of the DST non-aligned movement science and technology training programs on minerals processing and beneficiation continued. And then the department is also involved in CASNET Plus and RENIA projects that aim to strengthen the partnership between EU and Africa in science, technology, and innovation. And this CASNET Plus hosted a workshop on the role of technology transfer officers in the establishment of knowledge management and communication systems for the EU-Africa food and nutrition. Can't remember all the acronyms. Mampe can fill me in. So if we now go into the performance review, these are the DST programs which we've shared with the committee before. can see the breakdown. Program 1 achieved 100% of its quota 1 target. Program 2, they did not achieve their targets, and we're working with Program 2. Program 3, 40%, 4, 57%, Program 5, 83%. And this is shown on this slide that shows how the different programs have fared in terms of their quota report. So these are the highlights, so some detail on Program 1 performance. On the vacancy rate, we've maintained the 10% that we're hoping to achieve. In the number of media articles published, we had a target of 4, we achieved 10. On the public participation, we were supposed to have 2, and then we had 4. On the technology innovation, as we've indicated, none of the targets were achieved, and we are working with the DDG and the management there to try and understand what were the challenges. On Program 3, the committee would know that the minister was, of course, given this Grand Cross of Merit of the Federal Republic of Germany, as well as, I think, a couple of honorary degrees that she was awarded this quarter. So we had 10 international partner organizations that we were working with, 112 were approached. On the dedicated international exchanges, 5, and then we had 9, so this has been achieved. On Program 4, which is research development support, 1,568 PhDs for the quota, just over 2,000. On the graduates and students placed in DST-funded work, 708. As we indicated in the highlights, researchers just over 2,400, and then on the grants that were awarded, 93 and 13 organizers for the National Science Week and science festivals, as we showed earlier on. On Program 5, we needed to, through consultation and review, identify the topics and format of 6 knowledge products. We're giving the 8 policy briefs that were identified with the partners, and they are shown in much more detail. Urban Knowledge Hub, innovation in the delivery of basic services, policy implications of innovations by grassroots innovators, the readiness of information and communication technology interventions at schools, the steps of booklet, strengthening the voice of marginalized people, lessons learned, innovative local development through collaboration and learning and knowledge production. So once we've agreed on this, we'll then get closer to then identifying the 6 products that will be published by 31st of March. On the decision support, we were supposed to just have monitor the implementation of work plans for the 7 existing decision support. 9 were monitored. On the learning interventions, we were supposed to conclude the contract and the HSRC, this was done. Update on ongoing monitoring of students from following initiatives, we had a total of 99 students that were funded. So we think we are going to meet the target. On the knowledge products, interactions with various supported initiatives to define new. We have had 6 IP products that have been identified as potential additions to the intellectual property portfolio. On the master's and post and doctoral students supported, we have exceeded the target. On the interns, 128 interns fully funded against 100. And then the negotiations with implementing agencies on the proposed knowledge and innovation products, we have started these, and then looks at the instruments, this was also achieved. Consultation to identify support, interventions to be implemented. We've already had this with 6 support interventions identified. And then gathering data, evidence from projects. It's already been completed for 3 of the 4 policy briefs that require data gathering. We have, of course, targets that were not achieved, and we've classified the reasons into 3, process delays, ineffectiveness of the implementers, and target formulation challenges. So on the disclosures, we were hoping to have 108 new disclosures reported by publicly funded institutions. Some institutions have not yet submitted their biannual reports. On the two regulatory recommendations for decision, there was only one executive committee which was established in terms of the GMO Organism Act, so it's just a process delay. On the number of, the amount invested by international partners, this is always coming a little late because we do need to receive information and we never receive it on time. So most of the time, targets in program three are always delayed. Same with the number of AU or SADC science, technology, and innovation initiatives. We always find it takes a bit longer to get evidence from international partners. On the number of research, innovation, and science and technology cooperation co-funded or supported in kind by the DST, again, it's just getting the information on time. And then on the number of pipeline students, we could not get the number close to the margins that were supported. We have engaged the Auditor General to see whether we cannot formulate this target differently, because really to specify the number up to 262 outside 40,000, it's not always easy. So they have accepted that we may formulate this differently. Tommy may speak about the discussions that we're having with them, because this has been a perennial problem. On the MOU template that is being negotiated, this was just could not be finalized on time. And then the baseline project, again, was approved outside the reporting period. On the pre-approved decisions, we're working hard, Honorable Chair, to try and meet this target. What the Minister directed the Department to do was to deal with all of the backlogs from 2012-2013. So the focus has been getting external experts to get us to remove all of the backlog. So we are still not in the period of ensuring that decision letters are sent back to the applicants within 90 days, because we're still on the backlog. But the report indicates that by the end of September, I think we will have removed all the backlog, so we'll be only processing this year's application from September this year. And then on the conclusion of the contract, this was concluded, but outside the reporting period. So on the financial front, we just want to report one challenge. This is just a breakdown of the budget split, which we hope by now, again, the committee is familiar. Nothing has changed significantly. The bulk of the money is in Program 4, which is which makes transfer to the National Research Foundation, followed by Program 5. It makes transfer mainly to the Council for Scientific and Industrial Research. And then Program 2 transfers to the Space Agency as well as the Technology Innovation Agency predominantly. This is just the classification of the budget by transfer payments. Again, 92% goes to these agencies that I've referred to, and we use a mere 7-8% in the department. In terms of the planned budget for the quarter, we were hoping to have spent 27.8% of the budget, and we're sitting at 18.5%. The reason, Honorable Chair, is that we have been in discussion with the National Research Foundation to reduce the number of contracts for the work that we do with the National Research Foundation. This was not concluded by the first quarter. We've now finalized, I think, the contracts, and we have agreed. So we hope to see an increase expenditure, because the amounts that get transferred to the NRF are quite large. So in the second quarter, we think we should be back on track in terms of the expenditure. Okay, this is just, again, per program. So in conclusion, the DST will continue to play a central role in providing science, engineering, and technology innovation initiatives that enhance socioeconomic growth. We also are committed to
continue to strengthen cooperation with our partners in the rest of the continent to build capacities and support initiatives of the SADC AU and the whole of Africa's growth and development agenda. So with those, I'd like to thank the Chair and Honorable Members. Thank you very much. This time, Honorable Chair, the team said they are ready to answer the questions. They think the DG is working too hard.
Thank you very much, DG, for the presentation of the first quarter. Honorable members, let me give you an opportunity to ask questions or comments to the report. Honorable Goronoff, Honorable Paulson, Honorable King, in that order.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you very much for the presentation. You know, when I look at the DST's underperformance overview, the slides, you know, and you see so many red and so many yellow, it is something that I do not think it reflects the real DST. Now, my question to you is this not an archaic way of reporting to us? Should we not change this, you know, because next quarter or the end of the quarter it will be better, but If we, in other committees, if you've seen so many red and yellow in other departments, you know, you're upset. You are really upset the committee is upset and they will challenge the department. But there's nothing to challenge you on this. But, you know, on paper, it doesn't, you know, in my opinion, not telling the real story. And then, secondly, I don't know whether that is part of DST's job. But if you look at the rankings of universities in South Africa, you know, you will have UCT, I think, number one in South Africa, but they ranked in the world 248th. You know, is University of Stellenbosch ranked 306, KwaZulu-Natal 478, and University of Pretoria 678. Is there any program? Because, you know, when they rank these universities, science and technology is a very important part of the profile of such a university when it's ranked and its outputs and its various things they use to rank them. Do you have a program to assist our universities to make sure that they go up in the rankings every year?
Honorable Paulson.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, DG, for the presentation. On the first earlier slides, I don't know what the number is here. I don't have my spectacles with me.
Can
you hear me?
You can speak to the mic.
Thank you. The National System of Innovation, how do you quantify the impact of that innovation in terms of meeting, let's say, our triple challenges of unemployment, poverty, inequality? I think that's the whole idea of innovation, that we must meet certain challenges. So I've asked this previous years as well, is there any way of measuring the impact of this innovation? And then also, under the sample program for performance, you speak about the number of graduates there and the researchers that you're funding. I think for me it's very important, you know, and I know the department is doing very good work, but I want to know in terms of the diversity in that group, in terms of blacks, in terms of females, what is that like? Because I think that reporting is far more important than giving an overall number. I want to know that we are making science more inclusive of all the others, of people who were historically disadvantaged.
And then one last question. In terms of institutions that don't disclose, what are the sanctions that you mete out to those institutions? Because surely you're not disclosing and it's a condition of funding institutions. You know, you can't continuously fund an institution that doesn't disclose and doesn't disclose on time. I mean, Honorable Kurnov did ask, what are we doing about improving performance of our own institutions? And I think that is very much part of it, you know, getting them to meet with their obligations as well. Thank you very much, Jefferson.
Thanks, Honorable Carson. Okay.
Basically, I was glad to see that you highlighted the fact that when it comes to gender base, you guys are still working on that. But then you also spoke about the 80% for postgraduates, 55% of that is women. And then I looked at your Program 1 performance, where you basically state that you can't specifically predict how many postgraduate students there would be in the pipeline. It then makes me realize, if you have the 80% there, isn't it discriminating against others who could have applied? That's why you can't reach that target, because now you're pushing out people out of the system which actually qualified, but just they don't meet that criteria. And then also with your funding, you said your actual expenditure was due, the reason why you couldn't have the deviation was in NRF, you wanted to reduce some contracts. What impact will that have on the department, and which type of contracts are you considering they should reduce, because that will then speak again to economic development? Otherwise, I was covered by the other two. And then one, 10% reduction in vacancy rate. According to the budget, there was some critical substantive posts that was vacant. Have those been filled, or are you still keeping the ratio of the 10%?
Thanks, Chair, and thanks, DG, for the presentation. You know, every moment you make a presentation, one feels happy that we're doing good. And what we experienced yesterday was an eye-opener. But when one looks broadly at what is happening around artificial intelligence and our response as a country, it's like technologies developing very quick than what we are doing as a country to be at par with these developments, to an extent that we are going to lack skills as a country from where you are. Are we positioning ourselves to try and match these rapid advances that technology is bringing to our areas? Yeah. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Matale. Just before you respond, I think in the issue that was raised by Honorable King, the issue of the support for, you know, that's slide 19, postgraduate students receiving support are black, 55% women, and so. So do you have mechanisms of tracking that to ensure that there is compliance to these targets that we have set for yourselves, and if those that are supposed to implement are following that, and that by the next report or by the end of the financial year it has been achieved. On the BIDC support,
I just wanted to find out how far are you with engagements with other departments in supporting and taking over some of the SMMEs to ensure their growth and not to remain at incubator level or SMMEs and so. Also, the program two, I'm not sure if I heard the reason why the two, which makes 100% the targets were not achieved. If I didn't hear it, please explain it to me. I think that's about all. Or lastly, is that the corrective steps for, you know, areas where the targets are not being achieved to ensure so that we are in line, what we set ourselves to achieve must be achieved with those smart targets. I think, yeah, that's about all from me. DJ, you can take the easy ones.
No, thanks very much, honorable members, for the questions. They are all great questions. So let me see if I can each on some of them, and then the colleagues would add on some of them. Honorable Koranov, through you, Chair, one of the things that we have been reflecting on these targets is at three levels, and this is work in progress. The one set is at the level of what we call outcome impact indicators, because we can tell you everything about what we're doing with the number of students that we're supporting, but are they the number of students we need for the economy? We can tell you we're seeing an increase in the number of publications. What does that tell us? It's not an easy process, but this is the thinking that I think we are having, with the hope that perhaps by the time the next strategic plan is developed, we will have perfected this and hopefully engage with the AG as well, that we don't get audited in these processes, because it's actually difficult to assume that if you're training so many students, so many of them will make the impact in the economy. So it's, in fact, people say globally in the policy dialogue and discourse, there's nobody who has been able to perfect this causality. But nevertheless, we don't want to completely say it cannot be done, because we think there are areas where you can draw and measure impact. And then the second level that I think our thinking is at the level of outputs. And these would be in the knowledge generation, these are known. You know, it's publications, it's the number of books that you publish. It's the impact of that work as measured by the impact factors in Scopus and others. So we can't get a sense of where we are if we're measuring ourselves with the global partners for the size of the institutions we have. But we also want to know how many students for the system that we are producing we have in the next generation and emerging researchers. And this is something that we think perhaps in our reporting, that's where we should focus attention on as we report to you, and this can be audited by. And therefore, the other things that we report on are probably more process activities or activity reports. And I think as we refine this process going forward, we may begin to keep less of the process indicators and focus more on the output indicators, and then, of course, ultimately to the impact indicators. Because if we did that, then it would address, I think, the core of the question by the honorable member that says you can see a lot of reds, but if the reds are process indicators, it things that, you know, if you get right, things will, your output indicators will be achieved, and therefore you cannot draw the causality
of the performance of the department and the NSI on the basis of the REDS that we have, because we might be spending a lot of time reporting on process indicators. So through the leadership of Mr. Makode and the team, I think maybe this is something we need to go back and reflect on and maybe share with the committee at the time that we have reached a stage of being nuanced around the balance of these indicators. So that's the first response. The second one relates to the ranking of universities. The short answer is no. However, as you know, these rankings measure different things. And on the research side, I think they measure four broad things. They measure the impact of the publications of the researchers. They measure the experience of your postgraduate students and your ability to attract postgraduate students from the rest of the world, and I think there are two others. Your reputation as a research destination institution. So we don't work directly with them, but through the programs that we have, we hope that they are able to access, I think, what we offer as the National System of Innovation through the National Research Foundation. But I think it's a point that we may wish to engage the NRF to say, are there any of the instruments that we have that could help them even better? So I think that that conversation could continue. And then Honorable Paulson, the question is, how do we quantify the impact of the NSI? Maybe I'll respond, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, to two responses. The first one is that I think when we started to develop our strategic plan, we made an attempt to look at how the work of the National System of Innovation respond directly to the triple challenges of unemployment, inequality, and employment. And we had developed, I think, a slide that shows how we contribute directly to those with the budget we have. For instance, if you take the employment, what we would do is we would track the number of students that come out of the system and they are employed at the end of what we do. We would look at a range and a suite of programs that we have in the Department of Science and Technology. They could be the Technology Stations program where we support small, medium enterprises. And because you sustain their programs or their activities, you are able to make sure that employment is sustained. And then, of course, we would also count the number of jobs in the direct programs that we support. But we also felt that there are indirect contributions that we can make. If you're using science, for instance, to understand poverty and food nutrition, so using science and policy to influence how you can deal with the broader problem, as well as a range of other programs, it could be research that is done by the HSRC that, you know, ultimately gives an understanding of how we can solve this problem. We would be more than happy to share this framework of thinking with the portfolio committee and how we then measure the direct and the indirect contributions that we are making. But to quantify at the highest level, we don't, I think, do this in terms of the numbers. But what we are trying to do is to demonstrate the potential. Honorable Paulson did not have the opportunity, for instance, to see the agri-protein initiative that was launched yesterday. It is a program that is trying to provide protein to feed animals using waste, basically. And it's a small startup company that has been funded through Research and Technology Innovation Agency. It's employing people in Philippi. It's now going to export and it's developing new products. So we would have to quantify all of these initiatives which are supported through the system in order to be able to measure the impact. Our view is that the impact would not be massive impact, but it would be demonstrating the potential if these initiatives are being expanded a little bit further. So the direct answer is no, but I think we could do it if we were, you know, if we had to do a little bit of arithmetic in terms of if we look at all the programs that we have. And then the question of the number of graduate research and diversity, the detailed numbers are usually obtained through the partnership we have with the NRF. Our understanding is that on the number of master's and PhD students, we seem to have reached a threshold where I think a report published by the National Advisory Council on Innovation indicated that I think in 2014 or 2015, I don't remember, that the number of black PhDs were just above the number of white students obtaining PhDs. So maybe we're beginning to do well in terms of the number of students. Well, it did not say anything about master's students and honors students. So on the researchers, we do know that we have an aging cohort of established researchers, and we have to replenish them and we have to diversify. We have programs at the NRF, such as the Tutuga program, that is targeting the next generation of researchers and the emerging researchers, and working with the universities to provide not only financial support but psychosocial support to those researchers, because sometimes it's not only the money, but it's being provided the support and the nurturing that is required. So one of the conversations that we've started with the NRF is what would be the conditionality that we could consider to include to the grant to the established researchers so that they can do a little bit more of mentoring of the young and emerging researchers, including women. So this is something that I think is under discussion. Also, to work with the universities to request that perhaps the retired professors may be brought back into the system through some kind of a program so they would mentor the emerging researchers. So the answer is, the picture is good at the PhD and master's. The picture is not good at the next generation and emerging researchers, but there are programs that are currently in place that are trying to address that problem, and we're working with the NRF to see whether we can get the numbers that we're looking for going forward. On the disclosure, I have to be honest, I am assuming that you're referring to the inventions disclosures that I think were not met in the report that we've provided. I will ask Kerry Fowle, because she works closely with the invention disclosures as the head of the National Intellectual Property Management Office, to respond to that question. Honorable King, I don't think we are discriminating, but what we found was that because we have an abundance of black research, sort of black students and women students, we were not tapping into this resource that we have as a country. And the reasons are very, very clear, that the first generation of postgraduate students find it difficult to do honors, masters, and PhD unless they are provided with support. So this is not an attempt to discriminate anyone, but just to say, could we target black students and women students and provide them with the necessary support that makes them to go through the system? Otherwise, what we find is that as soon as black students and women students complete their degrees, they tend to leave because it's the first generation and their parents. And so I think this is what the ministerial guidelines are trying to do, to say how can we have a targeted support, but I don't think, in my view, from any of the last 2 years that these guidelines have been provided, any student who is not black or woman has not received the funding. So I don't think it does discriminate, but I think it's an effort to say how can you deepen and how can you identify and support those that would ideally not be supported. And the way we manage and report on this is that, Honorable Chair, which is a follow-up question from you, is that the NRF is then expected through an agreement that they've signed with the minister to report on, is this working and what are the problems? And remember, these are guidelines. These are not, if you like, prescripts that say you shall, what works and what doesn't work. And maybe we can find out from the NRF, or when the committee meets with the NRF, this is some question that maybe you can also follow up with them. The contracts, Honorable King, is that We used to have small contracts for transferring money to the NRF. I'm told that there were about 50-odd contracts. So all we did was to consolidate them into large line items. So we have science machines, we have human resource development, we have science engagement and infrastructure. So when we transfer funding to the NRF, it will be based on these four line items. And how they are split, we negotiate with the NRF, and then the NRF reports on this. So in terms of the impact of the work, we actually anticipate that we are making life easier for the NRF, but also for us in terms of just paperwork. And so it's more operational efficiency and ease of working rather than... And then on the vacancy rate, we have maintained 10% despite having been asked not to employ additional staff at the department. But we are informed that the discussions at the moment is that National Treasury is re-evaluating that directive, and maybe in the year coming we may be allowed to use money from goods and services perhaps to fill some of the positions. So once that's done, hopefully we'll have 10%, or we always set a higher target of about 5 to 6% from the DST. But we haven't filled those critical posts because we still expected not to do that at the moment. On the artificial intelligence, Honorable Matale, we've done two things. We've produced a discussion document about what artificial intelligence broadly means and how we need to approach it as South Africa. But this is just early work. But we do know that as a department and as working with the NRF, we have been supporting some of the areas that are considered as areas that will be converging towards the new industrial revolution. So we do, of course, support artificial intelligence, but we also support a range of areas, nanotechnology, robotics, and other emerging areas that will form part of this new industrial revolution driven by, of course, the artificial intelligence. But what we could do, Honorable Chair, is that when we have refined the thinking around this area, not DST working alone, because we've been asked to work with the Department of Telecoms and Postal Services, the Department of Trade and Industry, and the Department of Labor, because we need to understand what this would mean to the jobs of the future, and therefore working with them, we need to start thinking about this. So we've responded, Honorable Chair, to the mechanism and compliance on the guidelines. On the BID support, we're having discussions with both the National Treasury and Small Business Development for a fund that will be supporting young high-tech startup companies that are coming from the work that we do as a Department of Science and Technology in partnership with them. So the answer is yes, we've started the conversation. In fact, in the discussions that we've had with our budget analysts, it seems like we may have a windfall in this area. So we are very grateful about this, and therefore at an appropriate time for the small, medium enterprise high-tech support working with the small business will be able, and National Treasury will be able to give a detailed report. I'll ask Tommy to indicate which is the second indicator that we've not achieved from Program 2, but one of them for this quarter was the disclosure, which with your permission, Chair, will ask Kerry to talk about. On the corrective steps, what we do is, as the executive, we meet every quarter, and then we understand the reason and we ask the DDG responsible for that program to provide the reason and then what are the corrective measures. But because we're tracking it every quarter, we are able to get a sense of the universe or broad problems. But we also have the internal audit. In their audit coverage plan for the year, they will be doing two things. They will be looking at giving us evidence on each of this performance information and whether it's correct and whether it's helping us, and then they will be also looking at corrective measures that we need to put in place to address these challenges going forward. But with your permission then, may I request Kerry Fowl to respond to the invention disclosure, and then maybe Tommy, if you can quickly talk about the second indicator from program two that was not achieved, but through you, Chair. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, DG, and thank you so much, Honourable Chairperson. To your question, Honourable Hossen, the reason that we have provided there is really the operational reason, but it's quite a complex reason when it comes to the institutions. So the piece of legislation that manages these disclosures came into effect on 2 August 2010, and we're still finding a lot of our institutions just don't have capacity, and it's got to do with the fact that the institutions don't have the financial resources to employ the individuals within these offices of technology transfer. And so this is one of the roles of the DST and one of the roles of NIPMO. And so this is a path that we walk with them, and we have an Office of Technology Transfer Support Fund. But where the individuals within that office are not in place, the institution cannot submit the disclosures. And so the reason that we reported that some institutions didn't submit in terms of 100% compliance of the 36 institutions that report to us, in many instances, they didn't have the resources, or they purely didn't meet their contractual and compliance obligations of just informing us that they had nothing. The reality is that we have a number of qualitative indicators that indicate to us that fees must fall has had a material impact. A lot of the labs were closed, and so it meant that research projects were put on hold for a bit, and this reporting period covered that major fees must fall sector. In addition, for those larger institutions like, you know, our previously well-established institutions, UCT, Stellenbosch, et cetera, they are actually seeing a decrease in disclosures and a decrease in disclosures which we call actionable disclosures. And again, it's part of the maturity within their system. So we know the indicator is flawed in that regard, and we are looking at a way to still have this as a meaningful indicator in terms of the pipeline, but to make sure that the indicator is more within the control of the DST. Having said that, the consequences for those institutions who we are funding is we withhold the money. If they don't report to us, we withhold the money until they meet their contractual obligations. Thanks.
Thanks, Kerry. The second target that was not met, Honourable Chair, was this regulatory recommendations. We serve on the GMO, under the GMO Act, on the Executive Committee, which provides support to us adopting genetically modified organism in the food. So there are regulatory meetings. Only one meeting was held in the Gordon, not the second one, so that was the second unmet target.
Can I just find out on the issue of the pre-approval decisions, Vice Minister, where you've brought in people to help in fast-tracking and ensuring that they're done? You said it will be done by end of September.
This is the backlog. What had happened was, I think from 2012, I will double-check, we had all of the submissions that were requesting the R&D approvals. And then what had happened is that when the team was starting to process these pre-approvals, I think it started 2015 when the law was amended. And therefore we had this backlog. And the backlog is made up of two applications. One, some of the applicants were asked to provide additional information. So they were adjudicated and they were supposed to come back with additional information for the team or the committee to recommend to the minister the finalization. And some of them never came back. So we've been going back and seeking the information. In fact, I think there are about three batches of approximately 20 each, so about 60 applications that have been signed off, at least in my level, to the minister, which are dealing with the backlog, because we just didn't want to go forward until we've dealt with the backlog. But 15 and 16 and 16 and 17, I think we left with something less than 10 each. So that's why we hope that all of the backlog by the end of September should be cleared, and then we'll be beginning to deal with 15 and 16, 16 and 17 in this year's application, which hopefully by the end of the year we'll be back in the cycle of just processing the pre-approvals and the applications that we receive for the year. But we can, if the Chair would like, we can ask Godfrey to give just a formal report on where we are and how we hope to get the backlog formally. If the Chair agrees, we'll be more than happy to do that.
Thank you very much, DG. That would be appreciated. And honourable members, is there follow-up questions? If not, DG would like to thank you and your team for the presentation, and wishing you all the luck on the department and all the programs that you have. So we will see you, some of us will see you in Bloemfontein tomorrow, others will see you in Gauteng on Friday. So committee members will be attending differently and others will attend both. So thank you very much for that. Honourable members, can we have just a 10-minute body break while the BGM team are leaving? God bless you.
There were no apologies from Minister and Deputy Minister.
Well, we don't arrive if it wasn't stated.
Oh, okay, so I'll leave it blank because normally I put the apologies.
Oh,
okay.
Thank you. So, hi, are you a doctor?
Yes.
You are? Okay, so that's correct, because when I did the report and then it goes to the editor and the editor changes to doctor and I thought, ooh, problem. So I said,
I really don't worry about whether it's doctor or miss or whatever. It's a PhD, but it's neither here nor there. I qualified as a marine biologist, as a zoologist, with fishery biology. So I also had a really fishy doctor, and no application to where I am now.
Okay.
Except that it's still within science.
Yes. Thanks, Nina. Thank you.
Okay. All right. No, that's fine. Okay. Relax. Thank you. Glenn.
Go back and within the next 24 to 36 hours I write up the report of this meeting. And it goes on the website.
Okay, so it's the public, it's just politicians. You just come here to eat the sandwiches.
And get big salad. Okay, well, maybe my idea is because it's wrong. Well, you get a decent living wage. Unless you're donating to your party.
We have to change our focus.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to sell that. I'll lose job for free.
That's the thing. I mean, Cuba people don't steal. They don't need anything.
Do you remember there was one year when there was a problem at one of the fuel stations? Someone was taking money. They closed down fuel stations for an entire month. Only essential services could get fuel, so that they could go and teach people again about how
corruption deprives people of their needs. The culture is different.
Yeah.
We are millennials from now.
So, and there's no future that will change.
Yeah.
No.
It's too ingrained and it's too part of the culture.
They haven't concluded agreements, you know, with their navy and so on,
really?
But they want to come.
What more do you want if you're in Cuba, you've got everything you need, you know?
And all the beautiful women.
Yes.
Good morning once again, honorable members and officials. We're now on the issue of the committee deliberation and finalization of the protection, promotion, development and management of the Indigenous Knowledge System Bill. Last week there were just a few other issues that we had to amend on the bill, so that you can finalize it today. Others has just a bearing on consistency of wording or a term that we agreed on. Papra is still not well, so the legal service, the legal advisor from Parliament, but had a discussion with Dr. Renee here, our content advisor, and she will take us through on those areas that we agreed upon, and then we'll also give to the department to probably clarify some issues. Thank you, Renee.
Thank you, Chairperson. As indicated, these amendments stem from last week's meeting. So from the original PDA copy, the B-bill that was issued to members last week, we'll go there, page to page where the amendments occur. So the first one is the definition of curator, and that can be found on page 4 in line 44. The state law advisor recommended, just in terms of drafting, that it should read as the means the curator of Indigenous knowledge as the head should be changed to who is the head. And on the page that I handed out, the department also just indicated that stating curator twice is tautology, so they've come up with a second option, just to say that curator means the head of the Registration Office of Indigenous Knowledge, appointed in terms of Section 18 of this Act.
Yes, we agreed on option two. We all agree, isn't it? Yes, that's what we agreed on.
Thank you, Chair. Then the second point highlighted by the department that is that throughout the bill we should check whether correct part of speech regarding the word the use of the word license with a C and license with a S was used, and I checked the bill. And it was only on page 6 in line that was under chapter 3, and it was clause 5 in lines 40 and 45 where the word license with an S was used. Sorry?
May I continue? On the definition of curator, the option 2, which says is the head of the Registration Office of Indigenous Knowledge appointed in terms of Section 18. The definition needs to correspond with the content. If you go to Section 18, Clause 18 doesn't make reference to the head. It says the minister must appoint a suitable qualified person as a curator of Indigenous knowledge. You know, you don't find a link now to the head. And to avoid the confusion, option one was talking to the curator of Indigenous knowledge, who is the head and appointed in terms of Section 18, then you will find a link. But without the full names, then you won't find the head. There's no mention of the head. And for clarity, I would suggest that option one will be best because there's a link. It talks to the curator of the name in full of the curator.
Option one says the curator means the curator of Indigenous knowledge, who is the head of the Registration Office of Indigenous Knowledge, appointed in terms of Section 18 of this Act. Section 18.1 of the Act says the minister must appoint a suitably skilled and qualified person as a curator of Indigenous knowledge in accordance with the Public Service Act 1994.
I think she's correct, Chair. It's just that it's written the same, but she's correct that this formulation, yeah. So I'll agree that we should take submission.
Okay. Thanks. Shanas?
From last week's meeting, I think we had two different ways of capturing what was inserted. I inserted curator means the curator of Indigenous knowledge who, but I retained as, because I didn't hear as was changed, and Renee said as was taken out and replaced with ease, because then it also changed the...
Yeah.
The ease.
Thank you. Okay, so it's option one. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. So back to point number two, where I had to check whether the correct part of speech regarding the use of the word license with a C or with an S was used. And it was only in clause 5 that license with an S was used thrice. So the changes occur in page 6 on lines 40 and 45. The word licenses with an S will be amended to licenses with a C. And also on page 6, further down in line 49, the word license with an S will be amended to license with a C.
I suggest that she should use chapters and say, for instance, when is chapter 4? Nine, because when she uses the pages,
can use the article, the number.
Yeah, the paper that we have does not have pages.
Yeah. So we didn't bring the one from last week, which was lying.
So just words, when you say chapter, mang, line number, what, it will follow better.
Apologies for that, members. So should I go through number 2 again, just so that you can locate it? Okay. Okay, thank you, Chair. Yeah, chapter 3. Yes. Okay. So the use of license occurred, it's chapter 3, under the National Indigenous Knowledge Systems Office, and it's clause 5, 1G, 5J, and 5L. And that's just simply because there the verb is used instead of the noun, hence the change. Okay. Thank you. And then number 3, it was the request to insert a definition for industry.
Okay, sorry, can I just find, you're fine with the license and license. Okay.
It was the request to insert a definition for industry, and that is on page, it's still under Chapter 3, but this time on page 7, under Clause 7.2c, and it is the only place in the bill where industry, the word industry, is used. Hence, a definition under the definition section was not recommended, but rather that a sub-clause 9 be added to this section. So, the department was requested to come up with a definition of industry. So after subclause 8, which reads, NICSO must provide administrative and secretarial support to the advisory board, which is in line 45, there will be an addition of subclause 9, which will read, for the purposes of subsection 2C, industry means any sector of an economy dealing in the commercial use of indigenous knowledge-based products and services. And that was the definition put forward by the department for members to consider.
For me, it sounds like something that must go to definitions, unlike trying to explain in the body of the bill, that even if it's used once, then it will make
Actually, the reason why we put the definition on this clause is because it was mainly used only here. Hence, we're saying for the purposes of subsection 2, it's only mentioned there. So to assist in interpreting and understanding what industry means. If you remove it and put in the general definition clause, still there's no harm. But the technical drafting norms and standards, you would say if a phrase has been used more than one time, then you put it under the general. But if it's used only once, for clarity purposes, rather shift it and put it in the relevant clause only. That's why we put it here.
Thank you very much. Renee? Thank you. It's okay. Yes. So do you agree with that definition? Okay, thanks.
Then number 4, refers to the request from the department, in Chapter 4 on page 8, Clause 9, Subclause 3, that the word ownership be changed to custodianship. And there was quite a bit of discussion around this. And yeah, the ownership specifically refers to the property of the Indigenous knowledge community, whereas custodianship refers to the trustee or applies to the trustee. So with your permission, Chair, I would just like to hand over to Tom to explain how this now will read and why.
Thank you, Chair. You will recall last week you mentioned that I re-look at the bill on the plane. And I think at 11,000 meters, there is a bit thinner there. And so I did find an inconsistency with custodianship and ownership. It would have caused a confusion in terms of the trustee. So, Chair, what we've done is that we've proposed a number of options, and the most acceptable option was that we insert of Indigenous, if we're looking at 9.3, we insert the phrase of Indigenous communities after property and delete subsection 3. Okay, in 9.2 now will read as Indigenous knowledge constitute property of Indigenous communities within the meaning of Section 25 of the Constitution. And we delete subsection 3. The ownership, it was the ownership of Indigenous knowledge as property vests in the relevant Indigenous communities. So we're deleting subsection 3 and inserting of communities in subsection 2.
Chairperson, indeed, we discussed we had three options that we put on the floor and we've discussed. And my understanding, I thought we were going to place all of these options before the committee to decide which one is best. I would say I have a problem with the option, with what we have now, because what we have now, Indigenous knowledge constitute property of Indigenous communities within the meaning of Section 25. What we're trying to say here is that the knowledge, the Indigenous knowledge, it constitutes property within the meaning of Section 25 of the Constitution. You go to Section 25 of the Constitution, the property has been defined to say, for the purposes of this section, property is not limited to land. So the emphasis that was trying to be put to this clause was to state that we were trying to link this Indigenous knowledge with the Constitution to say it constitutes property within that section. But now if we expand and say constitute property of Indigenous communities, I believe now, if you read it, it's like now you are expanding what is stated in the Constitution. The Constitution didn't mention any property. It just said property is not limited to land. So the option that we have placed on the table to substitute to subsection 3, because subsection 3, as we had previously, it was saying the custodianship of Indigenous knowledge as property vested in the relevant Indigenous community. And then the parliamentary advisor, and I supported that notion, raised an issue to say the Indigenous knowledge it belongs to the community. Now, if you use custodianship as opposed to ownership, then we'll be creating a confusion, because the custodianship vests with the trustee. There will be a confusion now if you use the same wording for the ownership. So the option that we had that I would support is to, we had option two that says the indigenous knowledge of a relevant indigenous community vests in the custodianship of the trustee, just as an emphasis. But we need to understand what is the objective of clause nine in general. What is the objective of that? If you look at chapter 4 in the bill, it's about protection of indigenous knowledge. And then it says the subject matter of protection, that's the content of that clause, the subject matter of protection. What is it that you want to protect? And then when you read one, this act protects registered indigenous knowledge. That's what it needs to protect, this act. And now it put an emphasis now to say this knowledge, it means the same as the property, as envisaged in Section 25 of the Constitution. That's basically what this clause is all about. Subsection 3 was to make an emphasis now to say it vests with the indigenous community. So there was a proposal that was placed on the table. There were three options. So I'm not sure how to go about, but for what we have now in front of you, I would object, because for one reason, it's going to create a confusion with the meaning in Section 25. Thank you, Chairperson.
I'm just thinking of ownership in terms of property law, which is the real right. So it would be like the real right of indigenous knowledge. The one real right is ownership. So where it previously said ownership of indigenous knowledge, it was real right of indigenous knowledge, which for me was fine as you know, giving that real right of indigenous knowledge. But I don't know. Tom, do you want to say? Tom?
Chair, you are quite correct. Just to go back to the comments that Bongi made, the three options that were put on the table came from the department. We put the three options out. And I think Barbara indicated that the first option was the more plausible option. We could read the other two options out. Because the whole issue is with the word ownership, and that would create a confusion, Chair. So throughout the text, we tended to avoid the word owner, to avoid the use of the word holder. So in terms of that, we tried to couch language that was more, you know, I mean, although it doesn't specifically say it's ownership, but it alluded to belonging to. So if Chair could allow me, I could just read the other two options.
Thanks, Chair. If the subject matter of protection, 9.1 or 9, this act protects indigenous knowledge, full stop, and we don't have these other things that are there, because I don't know what is it that we are trying to address by the two clauses, 2 and 3.
Chair, yes, I do agree that the subject matter is indigenous knowledge, but surely it is also the rights of the custodians or the owners of this knowledge that has to be protected.
Even if we don't have subsection 3, that clause would read better, because one, it protects that knowledge, and then two, you just clarify now what is this knowledge, and you're saying it constitutes property within section 25, and that's enough. Usab clause 3, without even have it in the bill, it is envisaged in other areas of the bill. I would refer to you
Yes. Is it?
Chair, I think I agree with that because the use of the word registered, you know, during that process, ownership would be determined. So we can leave subsection 3 out.
Dr. Selig.
Chair, Prof just preempted what I wanted to say, and hence we included in option one of communities. So that's the attribution of the right.
Thank you, Chair. The state law advisors correct, there were three options put forward by the department, but upon discussion with Barbara, who is our legal advisor, she looked at what it was one trying to say and contained, and then also compared that to Parliament's legislative drafting style. And of the three, she chose option one because, one, it was most constitutionally sound in that, one, it recognizes indigenous, it protects indigenous knowledge, sorry, and it gives the community the right of the indigenous knowledge. And when you drop sub-clause 3, it takes away the word ownership, which the department did not really want to expressly use throughout the bill. The option 2 that was referred to actually says that then the indigenous community owns the indigenous knowledge, but custodianship vests in the trustee. And that's not necessary because in clause 12, sub-clause 1, it actually says subject to section 9, the custodianship of IK eligible for protection vests in the trustee of that indigenous community. So it would almost be like you're stating it twice. And hence the parliamentary legal advisor said that the most constitutionally sound option to put forward two members would be option one, and it would also then comply with Parliament's legislative drafting style and how the bill has been formulated to date.
Oh, sir, can I let you get Honourable Matale?
Yes, you're welcome.
Chair, the reason why one was proposing that we should take this, the first sentence is not that it's clean. It's nicely put. There's no ambiguity. Mm. With the first one. But then when you look at item 2 and item 3, it doesn't mean that when they are not there, what is written, what they mean, what they are meaning, is expunged from the bill. It's not expunged from the bill because it is in the bill. It's just that I don't know which sections, but I remember that the ownership of indigenous knowledge as a property is explained somewhere else within the bill. It's within the bill itself. So bringing it, when you remove it here, it doesn't mean it's not in the bill. It's there in the bill, including the item 2, what the Prof is raising, is there in the bill. It's just that we are removing, if we remove them here and we remove them in our minds, we will still find it in the body of the bill. Unless we can be shown that, no, once you remove it here, it's no longer it nullifies everything that is in the bill. You see, the when you draft an act, you must not draft it in such a manner that it, you know, everything else comes in. No, it doesn't have to be like that.
Thank you, Chair.
Just for clarity's sake, could I just read the first option again so that we hear the wording? The first option.
We said they're asking about the options that were before. Yes, the first one. That's the first option. Okay. Well, let me have Mr. Tom first.
Thank you, Chair. I just want to refer to the actual clause that honorable members are referring to. If we look at Section 20, subclause 4. On page 11, Chair. Clause 20, subclause 4.
Let me read what is it? Article 20, subsection 4. It says, in order to exercise any right in respect of indigenous knowledge under this act, the indigenous community must register the indigenous knowledge in terms of Chapter 6. That is 20, subsection 4. That's how it reads. Yeah. Okay. Let me have Bongi, then Prof.
Chairperson. The clause that I was talking about when I said subclause 3 won't be necessary is clause 3A of the bill dealing with the objects of act. I indicated that the ownership of indigenous knowledge existing within the community has been envisaged in clause 3A. 3A reads, the objects of the act are to protect the indigenous knowledge of indigenous communities. It's the knowledge of indigenous communities. That's the first one. The second one is in clause 5.1b, which deals with the functions and powers of NICFA. 5.1b reads, the functions and powers of NICFA include, and then you go to B, protecting and recognizing indigenous knowledge as property owned by indigenous communities. So by reading these provisions already, you can, the context of USAP 3 is already taken care of, because what we were saying in the original sub 9.3, the sub 9.3 was also talking to the same, the original one. It was saying the ownership of indigenous knowledge as property vests in the relevant indigenous knowledge. So I'm saying that concept is not new. It's been referred throughout the bill, starting with the objectives of this act. and you go to the function. So even if we don't have sub 3, the same intention would be achieved. And I need to point out, Chairperson, I think it's important to note this. We as drafters, we should be working together. And it's not nice here when you come and say the state law advisor is saying this and the parliamentary law advisor is saying that. That is not ideal, and that's not the intention. When we're here to serve this committee to ensure that the end product is of the best quality possible, and the law is the policy of the executive is correctly translated into law. That's the purpose why we're here. It's not about I'm the state law advisor, she's the parliament. That's not what we have in mind when we come here before the committees. It's just that we're trying to assist the members to achieve, you know, and get the message clearly in the legislation.
Thank you very much, Ms. Bongi. Charlene wanted to say something.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's also not necessary to include the words of indigenous communities in subsection 2 because, as Bongi has read out, you know, it's clear that indigenous knowledge is relating to communities, indigenous communities.
These items are managed within the other global lawyers at the World Intellectual Property Rights. That clause on the subject matter is important, that even if it is a restatement of the rights, it must be done because that's what they will look at in order to interpret what is that. And we've been debating over years around that particular right. That it must, the attribution of that right is what makes it different from the conventional intellectual. So we're actually dealing with the heart of the bill around this. So a restatement of a fact that we already know is good for legal clarity around this issue. So I would insist that we still leave it as proposed by option 1. And the deletion of option 3, I agree, has been restated. But the right of attribution is really in 9.2, and that must not be must be protected. But I wanted also to make a reference to the subsection 25 of the Constitution. It does refer. It's a flexible definition which does not delimits. So by bringing in intellectual, it is just enumerating that this is one of the other than land. So it does not contradict the constitutional aspect of it. It just be specific in this particular case what is involved. I thought we should just comment around that issue because it has been raised by Sis Bongi, Advocate Bongi.
Thanks. So are we agreeing that then for clause 9, we insert the of indigenous knowledge into sub clause 2 and delete, I mean, indigenous communities, and then delete sub clause 3. Okay. As it's stated on the notes that we have, it says we're inserting of indigenous communities into subclause 2 and delete subclause 3. So it will read, instead of initially it read, indigenous knowledge constitute property within the meaning of section 25 of the Constitution. Now it will read, indigenous knowledge constitute property of indigenous communities within the meaning of subsection of section 25 of the Constitution. And then we delete subsection 3 on B bill. Advocate Bongi.
Okay.
registered indigenous knowledge which constitute property of indigenous communities within the meaning of Section 25 of the Constitution.
Subsection 2, 1 and 2.
No,
is not changed.
I'm reading one clause.
Yeah.
Section 1, Quran 9, Section 9, 1, means this act, okay, let me read it properly. Section 9, 1, this act protects registered indigenous knowledge which constitute knowledge of, constitute property of indigenous communities within the meaning of Section 25 of the Constitution. I'm proposing that we have one clause.
9-1.
Which reads as follows.
This act
protects registered indigenous knowledge which constitute property of indigenous communities within the meaning of Section 25 of the Constitution.
For me, it sounds okay. Advocate?
As it stands now, with sub 1 and sub 2, I think it's more clearer, because you're making two statements which are separate. The first one is about what this act is all about. It protects this knowledge. That's the first one. The second statement, then you're saying this knowledge will constitute property within the meaning of Section 25. So if they're separate, they will read more better. Regarding the issue of inclusion, the words of indigenous communities, Chairperson, I'm just reading now, because you need to ask yourself, is it unconstitutional? You know, is it going to create a confusion if you've got those words? And if you read it, what is happening here, you are qualifying now, which property are you talking about? So you are making it more clearer to say, indigenous knowledge, concept property of indigenous community within the meaning. So you are making more clearer. So I would suspect then that won't be wrong. It won't be wrong, and it won't create confusion. You know, as I've indicated earlier, even without that qualification, is still fine. But for more clarity, and also to make sure that everything, as the professor has indicated there, that you need to capture it here, that won't be unconstitutional, so to speak.
So we now leave it. We agree to this redrafting on our notes. Okay. We agree as to the way it's stated in this document. This one. Yes, right at the bottom. The note is explaining to us what has been done to 9-2. We have inserted the words of indigenous communities into subclause 2, because before, in the old subclause 2, it did not. Honorable Matar.
I might be taking long. I thought she was saying that where it says indigenous communities, full stop, because it's unconstitutional. I didn't hear you correctly, ne?
No, it's just that I don't know why I was
saying that. Because if it's within indigenous communities, full stop,
you have to qualify that property.
Oh, I see.
Yes. as Section 25 of the Constitution, because it's got more interpretations.
Indigenous knowledge as not property. And so, by clearly stating it in the bill initially, we are addressing the mischief, not only locally but globally, that indigenous knowledge is also property. But for us, we are lucky that our constitution provides space for property other than land. And so what we are doing is just to say that this area here, we're invoking the authority of the constitution to back it up.
I won't die with that being inserted, but I don't see why we should bring the constitution into a law, because the constitution is the ultimate. So if you, when you write a law, you don't have to invoke a section of a constitution into that law, because in any case, it's subject to the constitution, this law. So this section that we are putting here in law is irrelevant, because the question has already explained what a property means. It's not necessarily land. So when we bring it here, it's almost similar to the court case that the Minister of Finance went to the court to say the court must instruct him not to intervene, while the law says he can't intervene. So it's the same thing, and I don't understand why we must put it here, because I don't know what we're trying to do. I'm not sure, but
just restating what's in the constitution and simplifying that when you read, you are also reminded what the constitution says about property.
That's why I say I won't die, but it's immaterial. It's irrelevant.
Advocate.
As I've indicated, Chairperson, what you need to ask, is it unconstitutional? Having those words, will it make the bill unconstitutional? Does this additional wording create vagueness? Is it ambiguous what is created here? And I did indicate it's not vague, it is not unconstitutional, it's a little bit confusing, but doesn't make it unconstitutional. So it can pass.
Okay. Yeah, for me it was just more like restating emphasis and reminding the reader. Yeah. Okay, we agree to the redraft. Yeah. Can you continue, Rena?
Thank you, Chairperson. Okay, moving on to amendment number 5. And this, I think, is also... it was just a word that needed correction. It was identified by the department, and it refers to the use of source versus origin. So, with your permission, Chair, may I hand over to Tom?
Thank you, Chair. This was at 13,000 meters above sea level, Chair. Chair, the word source and origin on face value means one and the same thing. But within the context of the Convention on Biodiversity, there are two different and distinct meanings. If I could give the example, Chair, we know that the rooibos is indigenous to South Africa. Now, assuming the rooibos then grows in Zimbabwe, and if a third party accesses that rooibos from Zimbabwe, then Zimbabwe becomes the source country, while South Africa is the country of origin. And similarly to knowledge, if community B has knowledge which was derived from community A, and if a third party accesses that knowledge from community B, then B becomes the source while A still becomes the origin. So hence we want to be consistent with the Convention on Biodiversity and retain the word origin. Okay. Chair, the word origin and source, on face value, they are one and the same thing. But within the context of the Convention on Biodiversity, there are two different and distinct meanings. For example, if I have to give the example of the rooibos, we know rooibos is indigenous to South Africa. Assuming rooibos then grows into Zimbabwe, and a third party accesses rooibos from Zimbabwe, then Zimbabwe becomes the source country. South Africa is the country of origin. Similarly to knowledge, if community B has knowledge that was derived from community A, and if a third party accesses the knowledge from community B, then community B becomes the source, while community A still retains the origin. So hence, we want to be consistent and replace source with origin.
Actually, following on from that explanation, the text for clause 13, sub 1, would then read as, subject to subsection 3, the indigenous community holding indigenous knowledge has the exclusive right to A, any benefits arising from its commercial use, B, be acknowledged as its origin. And that's where the change comes in.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. Thereafter, on page 10, under Register of Designations, clause 16, sub 1, there was a word omitted after NICSO, and it actually has to read as NICSO must. So must be inserted there before the hyphen. And then in 16.1a, after the semicolon, the word and has to be inserted. I think that was just a typo that crept in. So it will read as 16.1, NICSO must A, keep the register of designations in the prescribed manner, semicolon, and B, ensure the security of the register of designations.
We agree? All right.
And then number 8 was the request to write the full citation for the Public Service Act, and that was in its page 10, chapter 6, clause 18.1. So 18, the minister must appoint a suitably skilled and qualified person as the curator of indigenous knowledge in accordance with the Public Service Act. So after 1994, before the full stop, to insert in brackets proclamation number 103 of 1994, close bracket, full stop.
Okay. agree. I know, Advocate Bong, you raised this. You're fine. Can we pass? She's checking. You okay? Okay. Continue running.
Then number 9 was the request to delete non-commercial research purposes from clause 26 sub clause 4D, and that is on page 12 under chapter 7, clause 26. So 26.4D, non-commercial research purposes in line 32 will then be deleted. And then what is now 4E becomes 4D, and 4F becomes 4E, just to ensure that the numbering remains consistent.
We delete D.
Yeah.
Okay. So then E will be D, F will be E. Okay. Dr. Rodrick?
I would just like to know what the rationale for that is. So if a student wants to do some research and it's not for commercial purposes, that student will have to go and get prior consent to do that kind of research, even though it has no commercial value. Or purpose.
Last week we discussed this a lot.
The rationale behind the deletion of non-commercial is we are now being consistent with the Nagoya Protocol, which South Africa ratified in 2013. So all research, either commercial or non-commercial, has to require prior informed consent.
What we agreed on last time. Mr. Tom, you want to? Okay. Dr. Lotrich? You're fine. Okay. Those were then the changes that we agreed upon, and not sure if there's any other person who wants to add or comment. Martin?
Thank you, Chair. Just, it's a very much nitpicking, but if you go back to page 6, section 5, Section 5 of Chapter 3, it refers to 5.1, but there is no 5.2. I'm not sure whether that's a necessary one. It's page 6.
Page 6.
Section 5, it's a sub-part of Chapter 3.
Section 5.
Functions and powers of NICSO.
Yeah.
And it says 5.1, and then it lists a whole set of subs, but there's no 5.2. So that one is redundant.
But it's all 5.1. But it's all 5.1.
Well, because there's no 5.2, you don't even need to put 5.1.
Oh.
Just a 5, A, B, C, D.
Okay, we agree with that, drafter. Okay. Any other? Advocate Bongi? Carol? Tom? Tommy? Pro? Sally? Oh, you find. Thank you. be fine.
The number in Chairperson on page 13 is the same. There's no sub 2. It's 28.1 and again 31.1. There's no 2, so we delete sub 1. Throw out. Page 13, clause 28.
Clause 28.
Yes.
Okay.
And also clause 31.
Clause 28, clause 31. Remove the 1.
Chair, I just want to make sure that we can make comments now in general on things that we still want clarity on or maybe changes. Okay. I just want to find out, just for myself, to be very clear on this so that I know exactly what we are doing here. If we look at page 8, chapter 4, then... Eight. And then we look at clause 2 of 10. 10.2, sub-clause 2, under term of protection. If Indigenous knowledge ceases to meet the eligibility criteria set out in section 11, it falls into the public domain from the date of proven ineligibility. This will be done by the curator if I read further on. So is the feeling that that should not be specified here, or should it then be read with the further clauses?
To the public domain is an automatic mechanism. It cannot be declared. It's just that once its use has not met the criteria, then anyone could use it. But if we specify, then we'll make it the business of the curator each time, and then there has to be proof. So we're creating a lot more cumbersome work for the role of the curator. Even with copyright, the registrar of intellectual property right doesn't say this is over 50 years, therefore it goes into public domain. It is an automatic thing that happens because the criteria has not been met anymore. It falls out of that. So if we do it for this particular one, it will also not be in line with what other intellectual property laws have provided for. We could take the patent. After the 20 years, it comes into a public domain. It's not protected anymore. But the registrar would not say this thing is in the public domain. So it's up to people who are using it to prove that this thing does not meet the criteria anymore. Rather than putting the onus on the curator, you put the onus on the users to prove. I think that's the reason why I would say that putting in the curator there as a person who puts it in the public domain would cause such a challenge.
I'm concerned that should there be litigation, surely somewhere it must say in the Act who determines whether something meets the criteria or not, because the criteria is very vague and we don't have here specifically time frames in terms of 20 years or 50 years. It has to meet those three criteria in clause 11.
Just to answer the question on time frames, section 26.3 has time frames of 20 and 50 years. it's not linked to the criteria, it's linked to the duration of protection.
Still not clarified.
I'm just really concerned that it's there that there's no it just says that if it ceases to meet the eligibility criteria. Now, who determines that it has been developed or it hasn't been developed or is associated with a specific cultural? So I don't know. I'm just thinking in terms of should someone say, but I want to use that and try to make a case that eligibility has ceased.
Yes, I think the person who wants to use it without getting the consent to use it would have to prove that it doesn't meet the criteria in the bill.
As it reads, Chairperson, as it stands now, I think it's automatic. If it says it to meet the EE criteria, then automatically it won't be protected. That's basically what sub 2 is all about. I'm not sure if I get the issue that you're trying to.
Who determines what is developed? What are the criteria? Because B says has been developed within, and if it hasn't, who proves that? Or is that, must one subsume that under the registration, the initial registration, that it should have been developed there and it is associated? If that forms part of it, then yes, okay. But I'm a bit hesitant there, but yeah.
That's 11B then says has been developed within an indigenous community. Doesn't that cover your concern of has been developed? It would have been developed within the indigenous community.
Clause 20, sub clause 2, subsection C addresses the concern. Clause 20, subsection 2, C.
on the registration of Indigenous knowledge,
yes.
And I think Dr. Lotru referred
on
to the registration, that the trustee of an Indigenous community may apply to the curator in the prescribed manner for the registration of Indigenous knowledge and CSIS reject the application if it does not meet the criteria set out in subsection 11. Yeah. Now, and then it refers you back to what is in the criteria, which is subsection, which is Article 11.
Yes, I was actually asking about after registration and it then ceases to be eligible, to be registered.
So it would be rejected if it doesn't meet any of these.
At registration phase. But now, after it's been registered, time lapses, and then it ceases because it doesn't meet the eligibility criteria, but that, as I understand, is now just a process that happens. So it will only be once someone wants to use it, then the registrar will have to go and look, or the curator, rather, will have to go and look and see whether it still complies.
Next question? You said you've got, you are on the floor.
Thank you. Then this is also just for my own clarity so that I understand this. Page 8, chapter 4, subclause 13.1a. So it reads, subject to subsection 3, which is now about the individual member, the Indigenous community holding Indigenous knowledge has the exclusive right to A, any benefits arising from its commercial use. Now, as I understand it at this point, there will be an agreement between the community, the trustee, and this license holder. Now, what happens, because we have the IPLA Act as well, now, you have this license or this agreement. Now, this person goes and he wants to register a patent on it. So that is now an additional agreement. How will this agreement look between the original agreement between the license holder and the trustee? Because you cannot foresee, perhaps, that there will be a patent or copyright in future. How is that going to work?
The benefit sharing agreement is actually relevant to three instruments. The IPLA is too relevant, and also to the permits granting by Department of Environmental Affairs. So they also enter into benefit sharing agreement. So in this particular case, there is an effort, a process that has been started already of a one-stop shop. So where the permits for accessing the resource, the genetic resource, and the benefit sharing from the IPLA and the one under the IKBU are housed in one house, and that is called BioPanzer. It's an initiative which we're working with the three departments so that there will be one office. So a benefit sharing agreement, one of them would do for all the processes because they will be lodged in one office. So we had been anticipating that from the industry. They will be saying we can't be entering three different benefit sharing agreements. So we are making, and at the regulation level, that will become much more clearer because it's a regulatory kind of process, but it will be one agreement that will cover the whatever it is. And it will be coordinated within that office.
Remember before, DTI was adamant that their work and stuff, but they've since written a letter that they agree with the process, they agree with the bill, they agree with the way that we're looking at dealing with issues and the issue of the one-stop shop and so forth. So those regulations, as Prof has said, will then clarify that aspect.
Chair, just to be now more specific in response to the question, is that the licensing agreement and the patent are two separate documents. The patent is to register the right, and the licensing agreement is to further commercialize that product. And last week we did discuss whether it would be an exclusive right or a non-exclusive right. The general trend with indigenous knowledge is a non-exclusive right. So you don't tie a particular licensee to one person. So in terms of the license and the patent, the ownership within the patent, that's negotiable. Whether the community can have 50% of the rights in the patent, but within the license agreement, that is where the royalties, the negotiations on the royalties and the percentage of the royalties. So the patent and the license agreement are two separate documents.
Okay,
your next one.
The others have actually been addressed, but then the last one, page 11, clause 24.2, it's under amendment of register. Now, in previous clauses, it says that the register must be published in different publications, but if you read 2, the curator must amend an entry in the register in accordance with any finding by a court. Should that also not be published because it amends the register?
Chair, may I suggest that the publication may be done periodically, so any amendments from that period would be published, you know, with the next review or whatever it is.
Chair, I'm in two minds here. Whether a finding is always published, and then now to republish it within that, wouldn't that be an? Because any finding is a publication. I mean, in any court decision, you'll find it in it's in a public domain. So now to republish it in that. I'm not too sure.
Business, I understand it's a register of what is registered indigenous knowledge. Now, should there have been a dispute, something was on the register, now it's not on the register, or the community has changed, surely that should be made available so that anyone who wants to apply for it to be registered have or want to use it will have to have the correct information.
Mine is not working. Okay. The provision suggested by Shanine, I think that the periodic publication will make the point mute. It's not necessary to mention it because the periodic publication will update the database. Thank you.
And then just the last one, Chair. Last one. Things happen. Chairperson, this is just, I'm looking for that one now. It is page 13. chapter 9, clause 31. Now, I know that this does not necessarily have to be mentioned, but I just want to mention it here that usually the devil is in the regulation. And I don't know whether, because as it stands here, the minister may make regulations. And that's it. The minister is at liberty to make any regulation. So there is no parliamentary process in terms of submitting it to parliament. I don't know how possible that is, but that is usually where the problems come in.
If I can assist, I know, you know, that is always for opposition, but, you know, anybody might be in opposition in future. It is a problem. So you must regulate that is in the best interest for everybody. But I know in trade and industry, we have always, all the trade and industry regulations or the majority is coming to the committee. So we can just say that the regulations must be, the committee must be informed. Parliament must be informed.
Thank you, Chair. I must say... I acknowledge that the questions that Honourable has raised are very pertinent and relevant because they speak to some blind spaces which as drafters you may not. So I think that is really good. Around this one, I think that there's even been an example of some of our DST regulations which have come back to the House. So we do not object. I think we could include that. Yeah.
Chair, just a textual issue at clause, a font issue at clause 23. I think the font appears to be bigger than the A and B. 23. Yeah.
Clause
23. Yeah, I think the font in the sentence preceding A and B is different. The font in A and B.
What are you saying? Please buy his spectacles.
Okay. Okay. Now that you've raised and clarified all these issues and actually dealing with more trying to cover what Dr. Lotrit was raising, but in a formal manner, I would then want to put to the committee the bill itself and any matter on page 2 of the bill itself, the bill and the preamble. On the arrangement of sections, then it goes up to page 4, and then on chapter 1, the definition. On chapter 2, application and objects of the act. Chapter 3, National Indigenous Knowledge System Office. Chapter 4, protection of indigenous knowledge. Respond. Okay. Chapter 5, recognition of prior learning of indigenous knowledge practitioners. Chapter 6, registration of indigenous knowledge. Yes.
just as a clarity, a matter of clarity. As you were debating, I was still thinking through the proposed changes to clause 24. Amendment, on the amendment of register. I was trying to look throughout that chapter. There's no, the suggestion that was made was that we should insert now a subclause that will deal with the periodic publication of amendments, because this clause deals with amendments to the register. I was checking the register and I couldn't find any provision providing for the publication of the register. Instead, the register is open for public inspection. Now, in the amendments, where the amendments, we're saying now it should be published. Oh, just for clarity purposes, otherwise I don't have a problem with the clause.
If it's public and it's open, so even the amendment will be open, I think. You find Dr. Lotrit?
It was in terms of 20, clause 20, subclause 3B, the curator must, within 30 days after the registration of the Indigenous knowledge, publish in the prescribed form a notice of registration in the Indigenous knowledge bulletin and any appropriate publication. My question was actually then that if it is changed because of a court finding, because then in the existing publications it would still be that is registered Indigenous knowledge, but now a change has occurred. How is that dealt with? That was
he responded to that concern. And then in any event, a bulletin is always updated.
Chapter 7? Okay. Chapter 8, enforcement of rights. Agreed. Chapter 9, general provisions. And then page 15 is the memorandum on the object of the protection, promotion, development, and management of Indigenous Knowledge Bill. So now I put the whole bill to honourable members. Honourable Lotrit, Dr. Lotrit.
Chairperson, although we've gone through all the clauses and I think most of our issues have been dealt with, we first have to put it to our caucus before we can approve the bill as such. So we reserve our opinion on it for now.
Yes, sir. ANC?
We adopt the bill as presented.
Okay. The second for Honorable Koronoff.
Second.
Let's have gender balance. Honorable Tuck.
Report of the Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology on the Protection, Promotion, Development and Management of the Indigenous Knowledge Bill B617, dated 13 September 2017. The Portfolio Committee on Science and Technology, having considered the subject of the Protection, Promotion, Development and Management of Indigenous Knowledge Bill B6-2017 National Assembly Section 76, referred to it and classified by the Joint tagging mechanism as a Section 76 bill presents a redraft of the bill B6B 2017. That's the short version, and then we agreed that we will put a few points just to capture the process we followed. So I'm reading it out. On 12 April 2016, the Minister of Science and Technology introduced the Protection, Promotion, Development and Management of Indigenous Knowledge Bill to the National Assembly. The bill was referred to the Joint Tagging Mechanism on 25 May 2016. The later ATC reflected the JTM in terms of Joint Rule 166, the bill classified as a Section 76 bill. The Secretary to Parliament referred the bill for comment to the National House of Traditional Leaders on 2 June 2016 as the bill falls within the ambit of the Section 18(1) of the Traditional Leadership and Governance Framework Act 2003, number 41 of 2003. The input of the National House of Traditional Leaders were received on 27 June 2016 due to the extended Parliament recess. To accommodate the political program for local government elections, the committee commenced its deliberation on the IK poll during the third and fourth parliamentary terms of 2016. So on 17 August 2016, the committee held a joint workshop with the Select Committee on Communications and Public Enterprises to consider the global and national context, as well as the department's development under its IK program. The committee undertook to explore possible complementary and or conflicting prescripts within the existing legislation or in legislation that was being considered by other government departments at the time. Of the departments who presented to the committee were the Department of Trade and Industry, Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, Companies Intellectual Property Commission, the DTI, briefed the committee on its intellectual property consultative framework. The DAFF briefed the committee on the Plant Improvement and Plant Breeders' Rights Bill. On 31 August 2016, the committee had further briefings with the Department of Environmental Affairs, who briefed the committee on the NEMA, and the Department of Health briefed the committee on the Traditional Health Practitioners Act. On 7 September 2016, the committee invited intellectual property, legal, and academic experts, as well as a representative of the traditional leadership, to input and comment on the bill. From 14 to 16 September, the committee visited Gauteng and Northwest Province. The motive for this visit was to have a workshop with the DST and a selected group of expert practitioners and holders of indigenous knowledge on the bill. The program further included a visit to the Council of Scientific and Industrial Researchers Meraka Institute, where the National Recordal System was located. A further visit was organized to the community for engagement on the documentation of IK at community level. On 26 October 2016, the committee was briefed by the Department of Arts and Culture on its role and responsibility in implementing the 2004 IK policy. On 2 November 2016, the committee was briefed by the Office of the State Law Advisor on legal drafting conventions with specific reference to the IK bill. On 27 November 2016, the committee called for public comment on the bill with the intention of engaging the public at a public hearing. Based on the written responses received from the public, a hearing was held at Parliament on 24, 25, and 26 January 2017. From 27 to 31 March 2017, the committee undertook a further oversight visit to Oudtshoorn and KZN with a primary focus on IK. In Oudtshoorn, the committee met with the representatives of the Atikwa communities. The meeting focused primarily on indigenous knowledge and the role and functions of IK documentation and recordal systems, and how it was perceived and reviewed by communities. In KZN, the committee visited the DST-NRS Center for Indigenous Knowledge. Then I've got the date for that visit. I think this is just long. That oversight was concluded by a visit to the
Mapepete community
in Inanda to meet with traditional leaders and indigenous knowledge holders on their perspectives and view regarding the IKS documentation project. After extensive deliberations, the committee decided to present a redraft of the bill. All clauses of the bill were agreed to, and then with the we will note the reservations from the EFF and the DA report to be considered.
So that is the draft report on the process and the bill itself up to now. So would like I think it encapsulates every aspect, every step that you went through.
I think just the one thing that I think I need to, or we need to insert, was the interaction with the trade and industry, that joint meeting, and just the clause to capture that whole thing so that we clear the idea is that so that we covered all our tracks, basically.
Yeah,
Okay.
Honourable Coroner.
I'm opposing adoption of the report with amendment.
Very much. I would like to take an opportunity of thanking all the members, each and every one of you, for the effort that you've taken, the time that you've taken to consider the bill, engaging in it, pointing out areas of concern, and just the effort of driving it during the public hearings, committee meetings, and throughout the process that we're dealing with the bill. The Office of the Minister for being there, also pointing out issues and contributing positively to the enrichment of the bill, to the team led by Prof. Seleti, for all the efforts that you had started even before the bill was brought to us, the enriching ourselves and our understanding on what this bill really entails. Maybe in the beginning we didn't even understand if it's going to excite us, but eventually we all got excited. But you took us through. You were with us every step of the way, and the advocate, the state law advisor, thank you very much for being there from the beginning, also bringing to our attention the drafting styles and what have you, and areas and consistencies in this bill. Also, the Barbara, the parliamentary legal advisor, for actually working with us, for taking us through, for bringing to our attention areas that might be problematic, and also being part of the drafting team. Thank you very much, Renee. Thank you. Even if you were not around for some time, and you came back with a bang, and you just fitted into the whole process. You were there also, even when you had to step in when Barbara was not there, to bring us to where we are. I think we take pride as a committee and jointly as a collective here seated. And we know that we will get positive responses from the DA and the EFF, because you've been part of this process, and you will convince your caucus as to why it's correct to agree and on the adoption as a committee. We will then submit the report and the bill itself to be ATC'd, and then also will be informed of the day that it will be tabled for presentation in the House and the adoption by the House, so that it can be sent through to the NCOP. And in the NCOP, because we are Parliament, we will, if available, with their schedule of public hearings, if we are available in our respective provinces, to accompany them also to... to bring to their attention or to highlight some areas that they might not be aware of. But I'm sure the whole team will be there, and we hope that they will do justice to the whole engagement with provinces. I think it is something, also a meeting that we'll have also with the chairperson of the Select Committee, and also to the chairperson of the NCOP and the chief whip, to ensure that those provincial delegates, when they go back to the provinces and brief provinces, if they're not sure how to brief provinces, maybe they can ask help from our staff. We can accompany them to provinces to present and the bill itself. But once again, thank you for just being there, for ensuring that we continuously being excited in a bill that we believe that will protect and promote our indigenous knowledge, something that we had ourselves during public hearings, that it was a real bone of contention to the indigenous communities. What I also liked with the bill is that it also opened my own eyes as to some of the things that I didn't think of them as indigenous knowledge. We'll also be going to register some knowledge that we've got to know from generations to generations and stuff like that. But and on behalf of the minister, we will also thank the DG and everybody. Thank you very much. So I think that then brings us to the end of the meeting. Team IKS Bill. Thank you very much. God bless.
Bye-bye.